Time to take a look at the world of insects on the program today. Larry Mueller here, and P.J. Leash is back with us. Great to have him come by again. He's manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. We can talk about all kinds of things relating to insects. There's kissing bugs, there's assassin bugs, chagas, there are mosquitoes, there's nothing in the world of insects we can't talk about with you. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got something on your mind relating to a bug. Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. BJ, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. It's great to be here today.
Earlier this month, a study suggested that Chagas disease is widespread and endemic, is it in Wisconsin yet?
Generally speaking, no. If I went back and looked at some of the statistics, there may be cases, but they would be travel related.
Okay.
And for the most part, the Chagas disease, it's primarily an issue, and it links up very tightly with the biology of a specific insect called kissing bugs, which are a type of assassin bug. But these kissing bugs, for the most part, tend to be found in parts of South America, Central America. They do make it into some parts of the southern U.S., not particularly common. The northernmost records I've seen have been about southern to maybe mid-Illinois, but really pretty uncommon and rare in the northern parts of the range. So it very much is kind of a southern issue. But what those recent reports said is, yeah, in some southern parts of the U.S., it may be an endemic issue now.
So it's a parasitic condition.
It is, yeah. So it's a organism called a trypanosome. It's a single-celled little worm-like organism that causes Chagas disease, and it is transmitted by an insect called the kissing bug, which is one type of assassin bug. And the route of transmission is actually rather interesting. When we think of mosquitoes biting us and maybe transmitting a disease, you know, a mosquito bites you, in with their saliva, there could be transmission of disease pathogens, and so that's how it gets spread. With kissing bugs, that's not how it works. What they actually do is they bite, and they're doing this generally at night in the dark. So they would take a blood meal, and then sounds a little gross, but they basically leave their droppings. And if that is on your skin and then you in turn itch the area and scratch it into a little wound, that's how transmission actually occurs, not through the bite. Again, for us here in Wisconsin, this is really the main thing I want to emphasize about Chagas and kissing disease. This really is not a Wisconsin issue for us. We don't have these kissing bugs here. As I said, they really are kind of a southern issue. If I wanted to go looking for kissing bugs, I'd probably go down to like rural parts of Mexico and locations like that.
There you're going to find them.
Right, right. And they're not specific to humans. I mean, really, they can be associated with nests of various mammals, rodents, things like that. But if you are in a area where they live, they can potentially make it into your house. But again, for Wisconsin, not an issue for us up here.
Well, one thing we do have plenty of is mosquitoes, and particularly in the Milwaukee area, those flash floods must have created a huge increase in mosquitoes, I would think.
Yeah. So we had those historic flooding events in Milwaukee in early August. And anytime something like that happens, you can almost, you know, mark your calendar for about two or so weeks later, and then boom, mosquitoes out in force. And that's exactly what happened. I happened to be out on vacation at the time, but I got all sorts of phone calls and emails from the Milwaukee area. What's going on with these mosquitoes? If we take a step backwards, we actually saw something very, very similar here in Madison area in Dane County. I think it was back in 2018. It was about maybe second or third week of August. We had a very heavy flooding event where I live in Middleton. It dropped about 10, 12 inches of rain.
I remember it well.
Yeah. A lot of carpet out on the curb from that one. And there are specific mosquitoes that we refer to commonly as floodwater mosquitoes. And their strategy is they had previously laid eggs out in low-lying areas in the woods, so not in water. Their strategy, they stick it out there in a spot that's prone to flooding. Then when the rains come, that kind of lights the fuse, so to speak. It's a ticking time bomb. And about 10 to 14 days later, depending on the temperature, if it's warm, a little bit faster, if it's cool, a little bit slower, huge numbers of mosquitoes. If there's a silver lining to this, and I now just in the last couple of days, I've been hearing from folks in the Milwaukee area that, yeah, it seems like the mosquito pressure is starting to go down a little bit, which is about what I would have guessed when we had that similar situation in 2018 here in Dane County. It was about the second week of September, we started getting some cooler temperatures, and that started winding down the mosquito season.
Okay. And are those mosquitoes biters?
They are, yeah. And they can be fierce biters.
Okay.
So quite a nuisance issue. Some good news, though, is those floodwater mosquitoes usually don't play much of any role in terms of disease transmission.
Oh,
so
okay.
There's some trade-offs there. Interestingly, there is a different mosquito species called the northern house mosquito, Culex pipiens. That is a key player with West Nile virus. Now, those northern house mosquitoes, they really love to lay eggs in areas that will hold water for long periods of time. And in an urban area, that can be a rainwater catch basin or cistern associated with the street. And so if that water sits there for a couple of weeks, you can get more mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. What happens, though, is if you get flooding, it actually washes those out. And so those particular mosquitoes, they tend to temporarily go down, which from a disease standpoint, you could see suppression of something like West Nile. You'll have more mosquitoes overall. But again, there's some trade-offs there.
Sue in Eau Claire has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Sue.
Hello. I have not seen the bug, but I have something boring into a couple of younger pine trees that I have. I have older pine trees. I haven't seen anything on them. You know, they have a heavier bark. But what I would say would be an identifying thing is this bug could not have drilled holes in a more systematic pattern if it had a ruler.
Was it a bug?
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Sue, were they in like a horizontal or a vertical line on the trunk of the tree?
Yes, like several lines, maybe eight. Or so.
Okay. Yeah, so as Larry alluded to, I'm guessing that this is not an insect. There's actually a type of woodpecker called a yellow-bellied sapsucker. And next time David Drake and Jamie Nacaron, you can ask them all about the biology of that one. But this particular bird will go and drill and kind of poke in these very regular pattern of holes. It can be a linear pattern. I've seen it kind of grid-like in terms of the arrangement, and they will drink sap that comes out of that. And so it's often mistaken for insect activity, but it's actually a bird in this case.
And not a lot you can do about it.
Yeah, David and Jamie may have some tips in terms of how to kind of physically, protect the area or deter those woodpeckers, but that'd really be a good question for them.
Sue, there you go. You got a bird, not an insect to worry about there. Rick in Portage County, it's your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I was working in the forest the other day, and I looked over at a black walnut, a black oak, and there was a large caterpillar, bright yellow and lime green, and down each side of its back it had three spike-like things, and then around its rear end, for lack of a better term, it had a whole bunch of them, but much shorter. And I wonder if you had some idea what that might have been.
Yeah, and Rich, how large was the caterpillar?
Oh, I would say probably inch and three quarters, and quite plump. I mean, it was probably a little thicker than a pencil, actually, across its body.
Okay. Understood.
Oh, gosh, I'd say this is a case where a photo would really be helpful, simply from the fact that we have a couple thousand species of caterpillars in the mm-hmm. state. If it were, I'd ask about the size, because we do have some that are very, very large, like 2-3 plus inches. That's what I was originally thinking of based on your description with the smaller size, not necessarily one of those. So I think this is a case where a picture would really be worth 1,000 words to try and figure out which caterpillar species that was that you bumped into.
Did you take a photo of it, Rick?
No, I didn't have a phone with me. I was working with a chainsaw.
Oh, and, okay.
And so unless I guess I'm willing to scale that oak, climb up and see if I can find it up there with my phone. Where I'm, if I don't think I'm going to get a photo, but thanks for trying.
Sure.
And the whole business about photos reminds me that if you do have a photo, well, you wouldn't know Rick's, but if you have a photo of an insect or a caterpillar that you would like to learn more about it, send it to talk@wpr.org, email it in, and we've got access to the emails, and we can put it up on the screen, and likely PJ is going to be able to identify it. So there you go. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Elizabeth emailed to say they have an 1880s cabin in Door County. They've been seeing fine powder along the baseboards and thought it was carpenter ants, but a pest control representative recently told Elizabeth they have powder post beetles, and I would probably agree with that. Would you be able to provide us with information on powder post beetles and their treatment?
Yeah, so there's a group of insects, and actually it's multiple different groups of insects that we commonly call powder post beetles. There's multiple families, and depending on the particular family of beetles, their habits can vary. Some like softwoods versus hardwoods. Some like wood that is relatively new, that is maybe that particular tree had been cut down and milled in the last 5 or so years. There's some other ones that I suspect are involved in this case that we commonly call our anabiid powder post beetles, although now they're no longer family anabiidae, they're family tinnidae, but that's a minor detail. But these are insects that I will see sometimes associated with like old beams and barns and things like that, and they can show up sometimes in cabins. Now, if you are building something like a log cabin, a very common thing that can be done before you go and, you know, varnish or seal those logs would be to treat the wood with a borate or boron-based wood preservative. And this can basically wick into the wood. It doesn't break down. It's a very, very long-lasting treatment. That same kind of thing can be used in cases like this, but a caveat is, to apply that, it has to be applied to unfinished wood. And yeah, so if they're coming out of, you know, a hardwood floor or cabinets that are finished, you would have to, in theory, strip off the varnish or paint or whatever's on there, apply the borate or boron-based products, let it wick into the wood, and then repaint or reseal everything. And that can, unfortunately, be a lot of work to be able to do that. A couple other thoughts when it comes to powder post beetles. You know, if you work with a pest management professional, and you can do some of this yourself, but really do a detailed inspections and try and figure out where in the structure the issue seems to be. Is it widespread everywhere versus is it in a particular room? You know, if you were seeing it mostly in a particular room, say you're the living room in the cabin where your fireplace is, something like firewood can be in very feasible route of introduction. And so that might be something to look at going forward is what are your practices for firewood? Probably the worst thing you could do along those lines would be to bring in a bunch of firewood and just have it sit there and not use it, because then insects can pop out of it. Versus if you bring in firewood and you're burning it within a short period of time, then your risk is much lower. Whoa. For that. Occasionally there can be efforts such as, you know, if it's very restricted to a small area, removing those boards and replacing them or treating particular boards. If it is a large area, like a whole home or cabin, one thing you can also look at, and it depends a little bit on the structure of the cabin. If there is a basement, for example, or if it's on like a slab, anything you can do to decrease the humidity will help. So if you can very aggressively use a dehumidifier, The reason I say this is for these powder post beetles, they need the humidity to be high enough for them to survive. And so if we can really draw that moisture down, it's not going to be a quick and easy process, but get the humidity down, it'll make conditions that are less hospitable for them, and that can help you as well.
PJ Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, our guest today. Questions for him or maybe a photo you want to share, you could email us to talk@WPR.org or give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll get some legal advice from attorneys Emily Sellner and Mike Riley. Then Evan Daniels, owner of Cadre Restaurant in Madison, and a founding member of the Dane County Food Collective. We'll be talking about the Food Collective. So that's tomorrow. Right now, we're talking insects with PJ Leash. Great to have him back. And again, you can join us, 800-642-1234. Send your email, your question or photo to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Marty in Lake Geneva next. Hi, Marty.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. This may be a bit off base, but a while back, your guest mentioned something about a mosquito laying eggs in very low-lying areas.
Yeah.
And my thought was, could this or is this used as a predictor of, I'm assuming, heavy rains to come? You know, given the fact that, you know, low-lying areas don't seem like a damp, moist place for mosquitoes to be breeding, or, you know, most of the time. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I'd say it's not necessarily a predictor of rain. It's not like the mosquitoes can sense, oh, 2 months from now, there's going to be a really big thunderstorm or anything like that. And with that sort of behavior, they may lay those eggs, and those eggs may not hatch this year if the rains don't come. Sometimes those eggs can sit there for 2, 3, 4 years, but they're just biding their time. And then when those rains finally come, they can hatch at that point. So overall, it's just kind of a strategy that those particular mosquitoes use, but again, not necessarily a way to necessarily predict any sort of rain.
Interesting. Okay. Thanks a lot for that question. Let's go to Helen in Appleton. Hi, Helen.
Hi, thanks for the show. And my husband is looking for a reason to get rid of this tree, and I'm hoping you guys can help. I believe we have a Japanese lilac tree, and something is destroying it. It started last year already, and the only thing I can notice when I go out there and examine the tree is that it is often covered with ants. Are ants capable of destroying a Japanese lilac tree?
Yeah, good question. I think in this case, the ants are more of kind of a symptom or indicator, actually. And as a whole, I really don't see many insect issues with Japanese lilac trees. I see some in my own neighborhood, for example, and very rarely do I see something feeding on them or chewing on the leaves. What I think is probably going on in a case like this, the ants are present because there's some sort of resource for them, and it's most likely sugary substances like honeydew from certain insects. So we have insects like aphids and some of the other relatives from that group of insects in the order Hemiptera. And these insects have sucking mouth parts. So what they do is they will feed on sap from the plants, might be on the stems or on the leaves. They basically can't digest all the sugar, so their droppings are loaded with carbohydrates. We refer to that as honeydew. It's essentially sugar water, if you think about it. When you have those readily available sugars present, that can certainly draw in ants. And so anytime I see ants wandering up a tree or a shrub, I tell myself there's probably aphids or scale insects or some other related creature that's there, and that's the reason why the ants are. So the ants themselves, I think, are kind of a bystander. They won't be hurting the plants at all. What I would suggest is taking a closer look at the leaves. And one thing you could actually do is watch the ants, see where they go to, because they're probably going up to a branch or a leaf that has other insects on it to obtain the honeydew or sugary substances. And so that could lead you right to either the aphids or scale insects or some other creature. Now, in general, if it's something like aphids, those are really pretty wimpy pests. In my mind, they don't pack much of a punch or pose much of a threat to tree health. And so that alone wouldn't necessarily be a great reason to get rid of a tree if you have other reasons to do so, you know, take those into account. But aphids are not something I really get overly concerned about from a tree health standpoint.
I have a Japanese lilac tree right next to my front porch, and I kind of like mine, Helen. Yeah. There you go. You do what you will, but the aphids probably aren't going to be, or the ants certainly are not going to be destroying the tree itself. Let's see. We have Sumner emailing in with a question, and this has to do with climate change. With climate change occurring, what's the likelihood of kissing bugs occurring in Wisconsin in the coming years?
Oh, that's a really good question, and there's no way to know for sure. I mean, if you think about it very broadly and generally, if we continue to see increasing climates, warmer winter temperatures, and so on, I would expect that insects that generally have a more southern distribution will probably push their way northwards over time. Just in my little bit over a decade in the insect diagnostic lab and prior experience as an entomologist, I mean, it seems like certain insects such as praying mantids are maybe getting to be a little bit more common, bagworms and some other things, carpenter bees, which over time seem to be pushing into the southeast corner of the state. And these are all insects I mentioned that are much more common to the south of us. So over time, those will probably push their way farther northwards. So again, generally speaking, could something like kissing bugs show up in Wisconsin? In theory, yes, down the road. When necessarily would that be? I don't have an answer for that, but again, it would depend on climate change, and it wouldn't surprise me if those more southern species started to push their way farther north.
As you were talking, I was thinking about Asian tiger mosquitoes. They're relatively new to the state, are they not? Is that...
They are, and I'm glad you brought that up, Larry, because there have been some recent news reports about Asian tiger mosquitoes, and I have had lots of folks emailing me in the last week or so a photo mosquito saying, is this a tiger mosquito? And it hasn't been. So we have in Wisconsin about 55 species of mosquitoes. There's one particular one that we picked up for the first time about 8 or so years ago. I think it was 2017. My colleagues, Dr. Susan Paskowitz and her crew from the Medical Entomology Laboratory documented it. Some good news about that one is it doesn't seem to really persist here through the winter. Our winters okay. are probably a little bit too cold, but there's Aedes albopictus, that tiger mosquito, Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, and those two have gotten a lot of attention in the last decade because of Zika, chikungunya, some other disease like dengue fever. So that's a bad apple in the bunch. Do we have it in Wisconsin? Technically, we have picked it up, low numbers. In some of the locations we found it and have been like Milwaukee area, Madison area, there does seem to be this connection with tires, though. Tire dealerships.
Oh.
If you think about it, if you could design an object that can hold water and is almost impossible to pour all the water out of, it would be a tire. And so if you have tires that were shipped through or manufactured in, say, the southern U.S. or elsewhere on the globe, where you have those mosquitoes and those get transported to Wisconsin or elsewhere, for that mean, that can transport some of these mosquito species. And so that was one of the routes that had been identified for the introduction of these tiger mosquitoes. Again, they don't seem to persist here. So it's not too surprising if there were some detected this year. Overall, in the grand scheme of things, their numbers are pretty low. Disease risk from those is going to be pretty low for us, too. One other note about the tiger mosquito, and the name tiger is perhaps a bit misleading. Sometimes folks might think, oh, they must be big, they must be hairy, they must be striped, which isn't necessarily the case. They're really about the same size as a lot of our other common mosquitoes. They do have a very striking black and white pattern on them. We have a couple other species that have that too, so you can't look at that alone. You really need to get them under magnification. The reason I'm mentioning this is I've now had in the last week or two a couple of reports where folks have said, I just saw the biggest mosquito I've ever seen. Is it a tiger mosquito? And it's not. That's another creature called the galinipper, Saurophora ciliata, which is our biggest mosquito in the state. If you see those, it'll be burned in your memory. They are huge. They can be fierce biters, but that's not the tiger mosquito, and disease risk really isn't there with that particular species, the galinipper.
Okay. Rich in La Crescent, Minnesota. We'll give you a chance to join in. Hi there, Rich.
Okay, yeah. Yesterday, I had a tremendous visit from about 400 dragonflies. Do they migrate? Are these coming through here? I live out in the country, and they're zooming around, hopefully eating up all the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if they migrate or what their lifestyle or life cycle is.
Yeah, that is a cool observation, Rich. I'm really glad you got to see that. So when you look at all our different dragonfly species, they each have their own unique biology, life cycle habits. Most of them are going to be locals, so to speak. We do have some that are migratory. In this time of year, my number one suspect would be something called the common green darner. It's a large dragonfly. They can move in very large groups. Often this time of the year, I will get reports from here in Wisconsin, especially from like the Milwaukee and Port Washington areas along Lake Michigan. What'll happen is as these insects are migrating south, they don't want to venture out over the open water of the lake. So the lakefront kind of concentrates them. So there's some parks in Milwaukee where every year I get reports of just hundreds of these things. So very neat to see. But that would be an example of a migratory species. And then next year in the spring months, they're going to move back northward again.
Rich, thank you very much for calling. Owen in Cornucopia emailed in. 25 years ago, they had a terrible infestation of tent caterpillars. They were new to northern Wisconsin at the time, so when they asked around about how often this happens, Owen heard all kinds of answers. But it hasn't happened since.
Yeah, that's something that is really fascinating to me. So we have a number of insects that are called tent caterpillars. Every spring, we will see activity of a very common one called the eastern tent caterpillar. This is a species that goes to like black cherry trees, apple and crabapple trees, and they make the conspicuous silken web. And I tell folks, this is an insect you can identify driving down the highway in April and May when you see those tents. There's also the forest tent caterpillar, and that's what you're referring to, Owen. They will go through these kind of cyclical patterns, and it has been quite a while for a big outbreak of that forest tent caterpillar. So I think it was around the year 2000 or so. Many parts of northern Wisconsin had a lot of activity. I remember reading about roadways just being covered with caterpillars. Yeah. So it was something that if you experienced, you will not forget it. In a nutshell, though, we seem to be a bit overdue. I know there's some pockets of activity. I've heard rumblings from places like Taylor County, just kind of northwest of Wausau, for example.
Yeah.
But as a whole, it's been relatively quiet. It wouldn't surprise me, though, if any time in the next few years, we ended up having another outbreak of them, because when you look at the cyclical patterns over time, it's almost like someone hit pause, and when is it going to hit play again? I don't know, but it could be potentially any year.
As you were talking, I was thinking about webworms. The fall webworms, they're now building their tents, are they not?
They are. A forest tent caterpillar is another one. If I had a list of insects you could identify driving down the interstate, that would be on the list. So that eastern tent caterpillar makes those silken tents, but it's in the spring months. Forest tent caterpillar makes silken tents out towards the tips of branches. They really love black walnuts, but they'll go to a wide range of hardwood trees. Can be very, very conspicuous. I have had lots of reports this year, especially from like the southeast corner of the state, but I've seen them around in northern Wisconsin too. Very conspicuous. Folks often get the idea that they need to like urgently prune those out and burn them, which really isn't the case. Kind of has me scratch my head a bit. It's a native species. If it's on a large established tree, the overall amount of damage they cause is really pretty trivial. So it's not something that I get too worked up about, but it can be very conspicuous. If you had fall webworm present on, say, a smaller recently planted tree, then yeah, it might make more sense to go in and rip those out, squish them by hand, spray with insecticidal soap or something like that. But it's a very, very common insect. And those usually get going in about July. I see my first reports of activity. But they become very conspicuous in late summer and early fall, hence the name fall webworm.
Wendy in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Wendy.
Good morning.
Morning.
Having a bit of an issue.
Okay.
I seem to be resistant to most, if not all, insect repellents from the inside out, too. I've tried B6, B12 over a course of time one summer. It seems to have been my whole life I've struggled with it. Anybody else?
So what about the topicals?
Same. I've tried everyone's. I've purchased them all over the years, and nothing seems to stop them from biting through, even the strongest DEET that I've had to purchase.
Well, you are a lucky one, aren't you, Wendy?
that doesn't sound fun. You know, if you are the person at the party that the mosquitoes really love, that's not the sort of attention that you want to have. As a whole, we do know there are folks that we kind of informally call mosquito magnets that are just more attractive to mosquitoes and perhaps other biting flies. The thing is, there's not one like on or off switch for this. The reason someone is attractive to mosquitoes, it's more of a continuum. There's a whole bunch of factors that come into play related to our physiology. How much carbon dioxide do we put out? How much lactic acid and other chemicals do we secrete onto our skin? What is the composition of the microbes that live on our skin, the bacteria and yeast and other things like that? How warm do we run, so to speak? There are some kind of dietary things that can influence it. We know folks that regularly consume alcohol, that can make you more attractive to insects by maybe changing, altering your sweat. But also if you're actively drinking, the chemicals you exhale can be a little bit different too. And so everyone differs a little bit in terms of how attractive they are to mosquitoes. Usually the repellents will work, you know, if you get the higher concentrations of DEETs. Once you get above a certain point, it kind of impacts how long they last, not necessarily how well they'll necessarily work. But those generally will work pretty well for most folks. A couple of things you could try. There are devices that use a little heating element. One common brand name I've seen is Thermacell. The Johnson Wax, I think, has some little off-brand lanterns I've seen over the years. Basically, what these devices do, they have a little candle or heater-type element that vaporizes a repellent from a pad that's impregnated with it. And those will work pretty darn well. I've used them myself outdoors. The idea is it basically creates kind of a bubble around you to irritate and repel mosquitoes, black flies, and other things. I've done that when I've gotten to a park, wanted to fiddle, tune up my mountain bike before I hit the trails and fire that up. And within 2 minutes, it's keeping things at bay. And when I'm done, I just turn it off. So that's an option. Otherwise, something that would work really well would be physical barriers between the insects and your skin. So if it's not too hot, that's going to be long sleeve clothing. If you're outdoors a lot, doing a lot of camping and things like that, you can get mesh suits or a head net. That can be a very helpful approach as well.
Yeah. Wendy, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Mark in Sussex has something. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I have a question about, I was feeding the hummingbirds and the feeders were overtaken with, I think was bald-faced hornets. So this went on for a few weeks and finally I put some little jar lids with the sugar water close down below the feeder. And the bald face went to those lids, and they actually would chase the hummingbirds. So now they're gone completely. I don't know where they went, and I have a few yellow jackets, but the hummingbirds and those guys seem to tolerate each other. Can you tell me what happened to the bald-faced hornets?
Yeah, good question. I mean, bald-faced hornets, yellow jackets, paper wasps, those are all social wasps from the family of Vespidae. And they will go to sugar sources. Now, out in nature, that would be nectar from flowers. But when we put out a sugary resource that's readily available, like a hummingbird feeder, if they find it, they will basically tell others in the colony, hey, here's a good food source. Let's go here. There's easy pickings. I've heard this very same kind of case many, many times where those bald-faced hornets show up. They are a little bit bigger noticeably than our yellow jackets and things like that. And so they may kind of scare the hummingbirds away. In terms of why the bald-faced hornets disappeared entirely, I can't tell you for sure. in this particular situation? I mean, a couple of thoughts. If there had been a nest in like a neighbor's yard, for example, and they treated it, that could very easily explain why they disappeared. It seems a little early for a colony to be dying out. It's generally warm enough, still enough food resources for them. As we get into the fall, those colonies will naturally die out. One other thing that potentially comes to mind is if there had been a nest that was attacked by some sort of vertebrate, that also might explain the disappearance. If you think of a wasp nest, inside there are all these larvae, that's a good protein source. And so if mammals, vertebrates find that and tear that open and can tolerate a few stings, that's a jackpot of food for them. And so that might be another possible explanation as well. And lastly, if they just found a better food source elsewhere, they might have gone elsewhere too.
Yeah. So those are the options, Mark. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Richard in Madison, we go to you. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi. I was thinking of that lady who had just called in. We had these friends who went down to Central America to do some work, and for the first 3 weeks, they were intensely bitten by mosquitoes and other pests and stuff like that. But as they started eating the local diets, within, they said, about 3 weeks, said the difference was just absolutely stunning. It was like night and day. So very much like the gentleman said, that diet affects things, but that may be something hopefully she could try. And I think my wife and I both, she gets bitten. She's like a mosquito magnet, as you said, but eats a lot of sugar, sweets, and stuff like that. I tend not to, and I don't get bitten anywhere close to as much as she does.
Ah, Richard, there you go. Confirmation of what you were talking about earlier there, PJ.
Yeah, so again, there's a lot of very subtle things that might influence basically the kind of the chemistry and our unique scent or odor, and that can impact how attractive or unattractive we are to mosquitoes.
PJ Leash, our guest today, talking mosquitoes with him. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll be talking about solar energy for your home. And then later on, we'll take a look at strip cropping with native prairies plants. So that's later. Right now, insects with with P.J. Leash. I almost said Phil Pelletieri. P.J. Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Question, give a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can email to talk at WPR.org. We had a photo from Dean in Mount Horeb, a couple of photos of a caterpillar they found on their porch the other day, and I'm sure you can identify it.
Yeah, so this is a decent sized caterpillar. It's about maybe an inch and a quarter, inch and a half long by the looks of it. Very fuzzy in appearance, kind of some yellowish hairs, technically call them seedy on insects, but kind of this hairy appearance. The head is bright red orange. It's got these long black, almost tentacle-like structures out the front. And then right on the middle of the back are these four tufts of white hair-like structures that stick up. And this is the white-marked tussock moth. It's a very common species. I had a lot of reports of them this summer. The caterpillars are associated with hardwood trees. They don't really cause much, if any, noticeable damage. So mostly just a curiosity in my mind, but kind of a neat-looking caterpillar. So again, it's the white-marked tussock moth.
And Michael emailed a photo of a Nessa sphinx moth on a fresh and smelly pile of scat. What does it get from eating on the scat, and what else can you tell us about its life cycle of these moths?
Yeah, so we actually have a couple species from the same genus that can be common every single year, especially during the summer months. So July and August are very common time when the adults are active, and I will get reports of these. Now, it might have you scratching my head a little bit. You think, you know, moths, butterflies, why are they going to animal scat? Well, it turns out from their point of view, there's basically a lot of resources there. There's still nutrients present in that animal dung, some liquids, also minerals. And so I can't tell you how many times I've gone out on a hike or something like that. You see a pile of animal scat on the trail, and you'll have butterflies and moths on it. Sometimes folks think, you know, butterflies are cute and dainty and, you know, nice and clean. But I can't tell you how many times I've seen a pile of animal scat just completely covered with butterflies going after the salts and nutrients that are still there.
Kayla emailed to say they recently renovated their home, and while moving pantry items into the new kitchen from various storage places around the house yesterday, they saw these little bugs flying around in the kitchen. They think they are sawtooth grain beetles from her picture insect app.
Okay. Yeah, so we have a number of kind of tiny reddish-brown beetles that can occur indoors, especially in pantry or kitchen areas. And these insects are infesting various foodstuffs. So that could be flour. It could be processed stuff like crackers. I've even heard of them getting into other things, chocolates, bulk herbs, spices, teas, stuff like that. And in terms of dealing with them, what you really need to do is, you know, put on your detective cap, go through kind of item by item in your pantry, you know, find that infested item or items, plural. Don't stop if you just find one box. I would still continue looking a bit. If it's something that you say, gosh, that box is 5 years old anyway, let's just chuck it. That'll fix the problem for you. And you may have some stragglers. If it were my house, I'd probably chuck the box, take out a little vacuum cleaner and suck up all the nooks and crannies
for any.
Yeah, exactly. And then do a little bit more digging around to see if it's in any other items. Also, if you keep food things in containers that are secure and they seal well, that'll help prevent them from getting in. And don't forget to check pet food and pet treats. Sometimes folks overlook those, or even stuff like bird seed can be a potential source for some of these. So you got to check those items. Spraying doesn't really help. It's more of finding the items and getting rid of it.
Veronica in Bristol emailed a photo, which we can see here, of a very large paper wasp nest. They're wondering what kind of nest it is and how do you safely remove it?
Yeah, so I can.
Well.
Yeah, if you wait, that's going to be the easiest thing, absolutely. So this is from one of our social wasps, probably bald-faced hornet, just given the size of it. But some of our yellow jackets that nest above ground can technically make similar-looking kind of paper mache-style nests, but most likely bald-faced hornet. Larry, as you just said, if you wait long enough, these insects have annual colonies, so they will die out. I can't give you an exact date to mark on your calendar. It's usually probably sometime in October or November. Two things really start going on as we get into fall. The first is they're predators. They need to hunt insects for the larvae. They need carbohydrate source for the adults to feed on. As flowers start drying up for the fall and disappearing and insects disappear, they run out of food. They start starving. Also, the frosts come and finish them off. So if you were to wait until, say, mid-November or into December or any time after that, you can prune this out and you can keep it if you want. I have one of these hanging in my office.
They're pretty cool.
They are, really cool to see. But that's the story with these. If the nest were in a location like it's right next to your front door and people are getting chased off or stung, we have some treatments for stuff like that. You can get it at the hardware store. But if it's in the back corner of our yard, you could very easily just wait, and they will naturally die out this fall.
Nancy emailed to say they were attacked by several bees or wasps yesterday in the garden. Suddenly, they had several very painful stings and realized they were coming and going from a hole in the ground near them. Nancy always thought ground nesting wasps were large, but these weren't. Can you help? Nancy spraying into the hole at night when they aren't out, but hasn't been successful yet.
Yeah, so these would be ground nesting yellow jackets. And before you even mentioned the ground nest, Larry, I was thinking it's got to be ground nesting yellow jackets. So just like the bald-faced hornets, these have annual colonies. So the colonies die out. The only survivors are a batch of new queens that hunker down somewhere. In spring, it's a mad dash to try and establish new nests. Most of them are going to fail. What happens, though, is if a queen finds a location, and for these ground-nesting species, they're looking for an old chipmunk burrow or some kind of pre-existing cavity. Maybe there is a hollow void under tree roots or something like that. She starts a nest. At first, it's just her. She's got to forage for food, raise young, very easily to be overlooked at that point. The colony builds up in size and peaks in late summer, early fall, which is when folks say all of a sudden there's these angry ground bees. It's really ground nesting yellow jackets, and they've been there for months. They just weren't particularly aggressive and were overlooked. This time of the year, they're kind of hangry because they're starting to starve, so they can be a little bit more defensive. Also, colonies at peak size, more members to defend. In terms of treating for them, the aerosol sprays usually do not work because the droplets settle. Two options to try. You can go to the hardware store and sometimes find, and it may be the same ingredient, it'll be a foaming type product for like ground bees, ground nesting wasps. It comes with a little straw, just like a can of WD-40, and you direct it down into the entrance of the nest and apply it, and it'll foam up. And that I've had good success with. The other option is to get a product that is a dust or powder formulation that you puff into the entrance of the nest or pour into the entrance of the nest. And then as they come and go, they track those little powdery particles down into the nest. And that almost works like a bait in that regard. So those two options will work much better than your standard aerosol spray.
Carol in Verona emailed to say the woman who called about always being bitten by mosquitoes could also try, and we didn't mention this, and it's a good tip here, treating her clothing with a permethrin product. Sawyer insect repellent is for clothing, gear, and tents, not to be applied to the skin. Carol used it on an African safari, and it worked very well, last 2 to 3 washings.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Carol. I'm glad you reached out to us and brought that up. So there are clothing treatments. As Larry said, we don't spray these on our skin or our body. You'd basically lie out your clothing, spray it with this. There's Sawyer and other brands, kind of your do-it-yourself method. There are also clothing companies that sell outdoor clothing that's impregnated with this stuff, and those can last through like maybe 50-ish washings or so. So very long-lasting, and it does have repellency. Also, if the mosquitoes or insects contact it long enough, it not only will kind of irritate them, but it can kill them outright. And so that can be a good option, especially if you spend a lot of time outdoors or if you're going to some environments where there may be a lot more mosquitoes or risks, like, you know, parts of Africa with malaria, or if you're going to the rainforest in Central South America, something like that. That definitely could be a consideration.
You know, I had Dr. Zorba Pastor on my show yesterday, and insects came up, and he said insect bites between snake bites, I think it's like 4 people die per year of a snake bite and several hundred die per year of insect bites. And he just wanted to remind people, if you're somebody that's going to have a reaction, having an EpiPen.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and that is a concern for some folks with like sting allergies. Also, just when you think about human health, you know, snake bites versus insects spreading disease like malaria globally, that's a much bigger concern.
Yeah, absolutely. And back to the yellow jackets for a minute. I was reminded of a time when I opened up a bag, a half-used bag of soil, and took about 10 bites because the yellow jackets had taken up residence in that bag, even though I thought I had it rolled up. And man, that hurt.
Yeah, they don't need much of an opening. We have some aerial ones that make their paper mache nests, but the ground nesters and usually the ground nesting ones will also go to pre-existing cavities or voids. So that could be a soffit area, a wall void, or in this case, a partially open bag of potting mix or soil. If they find their way in, they can set up shop in there.
And it was not fun. Not fun at all. Oh, on that note, PJ, it's been, as always, a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we will look forward to your next visit.
Yeah, always fun. Thanks again for having me, Larry.
PJ Leash, he has degrees in biological sciences and entomology from UW-Madison, and he is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And he will be back, and we will talk with him again, always fun visiting with him. Coming up next, we'll talk about the cost of installing solar panels on your home or your business. Dieter Detling, project manager for Full Spectrum Solar, will be joining us. That's right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Thank you. thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to solar for your home and or for your business. I have friends who have it in their business, and they also have it on their home. Other people are interested in it. You may be one of them. And we've got Dieter Detling with us, project manager for Full Spectrum Solar based in Madison. He designs and installs photovoltaic solar arrays for homes and businesses. And as I talk with him, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What do you want to know about solar? The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dieter, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. It's been a while.
It's been a few years. So thanks for the opportunity to come and chat about solar with you again. It's things have been progressing, we'll say, since the last time we talked.
Well, you guys have been in business for a long time now when you think about solar.
Yeah, yeah. We've been in business since 2002, founded here in Madison. So we serve all of South Central, Southeast Wisconsin. We have a good history in
business. Yeah, you do. I was looking online at your site and seeing some of the very large and business-oriented or church-oriented solar designs you've put up and also home.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had opportunities to work both on residential homes of small scale, maybe, 4 to 5 panels, on up to businesses or schools where, there's hundreds and hundreds of panels. So a wide gamut of projects we've been involved with.
And I bet you've been really busy now with the news that the incentives will be going away. Talk
right.
about that.
Well, the incentives came about. There's always been, generally some kind of incentive to make solar more affordable for both homes or for residential applications and for businesses. It was always kind of a percentage of a federal tax credit. So you pay so much, say $10,000 for a system. Maybe it was 26% of that could be applied to your tax liability for that given year. With the Inflation Reduction Act from a few years ago that was signed into law, that allowed for a 30% federal tax credit. And it was what was really nice about it is it locked it in for 10 years. So as the idea and that bill was trying to target was to build manufacturing, build jobs in America. And so it was great because, I was doing that. Yeah. Businesses were investing a lot of, development production into their facilities. And it also provided a lot of stability for the industry as a whole.
Yeah.
And so as a result of the tax bill that was signed this summer, they are doing away with the residential side of the federal tax credit. And it was 30%, like I mentioned. It's scheduled to go away at the end of this year. And as such, systems need to be installed by the end of 2025. And what that means, installed, is obviously, put in place, inspected, permitted, permits closed, that sort of thing. There's the commercial side as well. That's still in play for a couple more years, all of 2026. And then in some cases, 2027, there's some stipulations to be eligible for that for 2027, portions of the project needs to be installed or paid for by a certain time frame. So,
Kevin in Eagle River has a question, I think, relating to fossil fuels and solar subsidies. Let's go there. Kevin, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I'm a, I taught environmental science for 35 years. I have a 100% solar home down in southern Illinois. 2 plug-in electrics, fully electric. We haven't paid anything for electricity in a long time down at the southern home. I used federal subsidies early in the game. They weren't as good as what had just transpired. But my question is just the idiocy of taking away a clean source of energy that has been has been shown to be stable, and it doesn't age at all. And taking away those subsidies only served to sort of equalize what the oil companies are getting. Direct subsidies this year, September 2025, $52 billion in subsidies.
Yeah. Yeah, you comment on that, Dieter.
Yeah, Kevin, you hit a couple of points there. I like to jump in on your comment about it's stable. You're locking in, you know, as you mentioned a few years ago, you locked in your electric rates. You know, you paid up front for it probably with some subsidies. And then as such, you've been paying off your, or not paying off, but you've been using your EV charging, using, you know, it's offsetting a lot of your electrical loads, AC, refrigerators, freezers, what have you. And so you've stabilized your expenditures in a way. We always are seeing that utility rates will continue to increase, whatever form of, power plant that is. And we're going to see that likely continue to increase. And, just locally, some of the larger utilities have gone up, anywhere from 5 to 10% per year. If you look at the past 3 years, it's about 30% collectively. So if you were to, pay up front, get a system in place, your return, your investment is going to be actualized pretty soon. Oftentimes with the federal tax credit that was in place, we were seeing systems that were installing return on investment in 10 to 12 years. It might creep up a couple more years without that tax credit. But yeah, Kevin, to your point, it is a shame that we're losing that that place in the world economy, so to speak, for the development and production of these clean systems.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks. And Kevin mentioned that, I think he said 10 years ago, but I'm not positive. But I got thinking right away, well, 10 years ago versus today, the advancements in technology, he's doing great with his, but 10 years ago or 20 years ago was a lot different.
Oh, leaps and bounds, Larry. The system that he installed to manufacture and the parts of it are probably, were more expensive than they are today. We're seeing that prices have continually dropped. It might be close to, a similar system might be much less cost to them out of pocket. We're seeing advances in the technology and as such the costs as well. You see the application all around the world in different uses on cars or planes, for instance.
No, planes. I just watched a video of a Swiss company or outfit that built a plane that they were able to, it ran only on solar. There was no other fuel involved, and they ran it around the world, and the plane flew around the world and flying both day and night. It's an amazing video.
Yeah, that's great.
And 10 years ago or 20 years ago, maybe you wouldn't have been doing it.
Right. Well, to your point about the advancement in technology, batteries to store that energy that's generated during the day has been a big advancement. Still work to do, of course, and, battery chemistries are, they're testing out new opportunities for different chemistries. But yeah, there's a lot of interest in batteries, both on the residential and for storing that power in larger scale.
What I guess we're finding is that the modern systems will generate more electricity from the same amount of sun.
Yeah,
light.
Exactly. it's the output's there. You just need to harness it.
And for a home situation, or probably for a business too, then you would need fewer panels.
Likely, yeah. We're
the same, compared to 20 years ago.
Yes, the wattage in per panel has increased dramatically. Maybe there were 100, 150, 20 years ago. Now we're seeing on average around 400 watts per panel. Could be a little bit less, certainly could be more if you have bifacial, if they're, say, at a ground mount application where you can harness some of the indirect light from below. So the wattage could get up into 500s per panel. And we talk about wattage and kilowatts. What does that mean? Well, that's the, you know, the power that's produced. We're trying to offset your electrical load. And everyone looks at their utility bill, and you see the kilowatt hours line, and what you're being charged from the utility from that source of energy. We're trying to offset that portion of the utility bill, both on commercial or residential.
Frank sent an email. What type of roofing material is best and lasts longest underneath solar panels? And he's wondering on a 5x12 hip roof.
Yeah, great question. Hip roofs are always a challenge because you can imagine you're dealing with rectangles for the panels, and hip roofs are generally triangles or trapezoids or some parallelogram. So it's trying to maximize the amount of wattage you can get up on there is what we're always trying to achieve. But to his point, what's the best roofing material?
Yeah.
I would say metal's probably going to be the long-term bet because those roofs last a lot longer, 50 years or so. At least they're warranted for with the coating that they have generally, from what I understand. But we can install on metal, asphalt, even rubber roofs. So there's a lot of different options out there. But we always advise if you are exploring solar, you want to make sure that your roof is aged appropriately to be able to live with the solar. You don't want to install solar on a roof that's, you know, on the later edges of its life, and then have to remove the solar and then for the re-roofing and then put the solar back.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And how long do the units last themselves? Jacob in La Crosse was thinking, well, if they last 20 years, will the infrastructure be upgradable, you know, or are today's solar panels going to last 30 years or what?
Great question. Majority of the solar panel manufacturers warranty their panels for 25 years, and it could be up to 30, 35 years depending on the brand and specifications. But so you can tell they last a lot longer, and they will last longer. There's always a level of degradation with any electronic equipment, right?
Sure.
But they perceive after, in their testing, after 25 years, they're not going to drop below 86% or what have you. They'll definitely last a long time.
How do we calculate the savings or, look at the, here's what I've spent. How do I figure out, you know, the bottom line?
Yeah, great question. Well, obviously, there's a price for us or any installer to install the system based on the equipment, the work that goes into it, the labor, the installers and electricians. So there's that cost that we know it's going to be. But we look at utility rates today. We look at their usage of the customer's usage, again, business or residential, nonprofit, school, what have you. What are they using in the past, say, year? And then use that to extrapolate what they will be using in the future. And then we can assume that, again, the utility rates will increase over time. I like to be a little more conservative with the rate escalator, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how we determine that return on your investment window.
So if you're spending, let's say you spend $300 a month on heat and electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's $3,600
a
year.
Right. And then what is that source of heat? Is it electric, say baseboard, or is it a heat pump? Or if it's a natural gas furnace, well, that would be out of that equation. But yeah, the air temperature and the electric use in general of the home.
So what's a panel going to cost?
Good question. I mean, it depends a little bit on the project, if that makes sense. A smaller scale project, you can imagine, is always has some cost to just do the basic electrical work.
Yeah.
And then a larger scale project, 300 panels, like I was mentioning, there's more DC up on the roof, that's the solar panels, to the AC side of the electrical work at the electrical panel. So it drops the price per panel a little bit. you know, it might be anywhere from 1,000 to, you know, 750. That's a fluid question, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm sure. And here's another fluid one. Michael in Middleton wondered, how long does a solar panel installation take?
Yeah, again, good question. Depends on the application, the roof pitch, how big the system is. In general, we see anywhere from a day to 2 days for most residential installations. Again, commercial installations are generally bigger, so they might be within a week. That's the actual installation. Obviously, there's a lot of planning that goes in place ahead of time, permitting, working with the utility and that application process. And then post installation, the inspection, of course, and then getting that permission to operate from the utility.
Tony in Mount Horeb has a question. Hi, Tony.
Good afternoon. New construction, 2,000 square foot house, contemplating whole house heat pump and a water heater heat pump. Any guesstimate about how many panels, how much wattage would be required?
Great question, Tony. Again, specifics. Depends on, I'd say, how much we can fit on your roof would be a good starting point. What orientation is your roof facing in terms of, is it due south? Is it, you know, slightly southeast? You know, those kinds of specifics. But also the roof pitch also can play into how effective in general the system can be. Is there neighboring buildings or trees that are shading it? So that will help us size it to try to match what your energy needs are. And then talking about your energy needs in a new home, it's really hard to gauge what is your, you know, you're living somewhere now. Can you compare that? Is it a similar footprint? Is it built the same with the same insulation? You know, some of those kind of variables can we can explore and try to design and install a system that meets your needs. But a lot of times, systems can be added on, and we've done that a lot with new homes. You get the base in place, and then maybe a couple of years later, it's easier to add on more panels, assuming that there's roof space that's appropriate. I don't know if that answered your question, Tony.
Tony, does that help?
It helps, but I know there's a lot of particulars you can't really address without a detailed discussion, but thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, Tony, and feel free to give us a call.
Yeah, and do you have... I mean, are there calculators online? I mean, do you have something at your site that helps out with that?
Yeah, we have a really base calculator on our website, on our homepage. So that's a starting point. It kind of gives a idea for someone who's exploring solar. Hey, what does that look like? What does it cost? You know, you can punch in your some of those specifics I just mentioned to Tony, your roof orientation to due south, your potential shading, you can kind of gauge that yourself. And then more specifically, what your utility bill cost is. And that way, it'll help kind of design a system, so to speak. It's a starting point. That's one thing that we have, and we use that as a jumping off point, like I've mentioned. There's other sites like one that's pretty popular. It's called PV Watts, and it kind of helps design a system a little bit, but it gets a little more technical than, say, maybe what you know, someone who isn't as nuanced with the ins and outs of solar energy.
Ray emailed, has had some roof damage during a recent storm and has to replace his roof. Probably a good time to look at solar?
Yeah, absolutely. When you have a fresh install on the roof, it's always a great time. I like to mention, wait a couple months, let that roof kind of bond or cure. You don't want to have anyone up there right away and it fully hasn't, you know, gelled, so to speak. But again, we're unfortunately booked for this year, but yeah, it's generally a good time after a new roof.
And you are booking into next year.
We are booking into next year. We install all year round. And from what I understand, a lot of other installers in our area are also are booked for the year. And that, again, to the beginning of the hour, Larry, what you mentioned, it generated a lot of interest and questions because of the cancellation of that federal tax credit. So yeah, a lot of interest right now.
Jane emailed to say it was mentioned that the solar tax credit for business is extended. We'll go on for a couple more years. Does this apply to nonprofit businesses? Jane knows they receive a check instead of tax credit. Will this happen for them?
Great question, Jane. Yes, it is applicable in terms of that commercial federal tax credit that I mentioned. Obviously, a nonprofit doesn't pay taxes, whether it's, you know, business or school, church. And they have a, with the IRS, it's called a direct pay, but it's that same portion. And from what I understand, it's that same time frame, all of 2026. And then if you have portions of the project in place by mid-year of 2026, that is also the installation can be finished in 2027.
And Kevin in Eagle River said there are billions of dollars in federal subsidies for fossil fuel compared to the what remains after phasing out of the relatively small tax credits for solar energy systems to begin with.
Yeah, and it's if you compare things, it is kind of I find disheartening a little bit when I'm in the industry, but I am worried that we're losing our foothold or our place in the global economy and as a leader. So that's unfortunate. And what's really unfortunate is a lot of projects are already in production and installation and or planning phases and were granted. And then some of that funding or credits
pulled back
are
even
being
though,
pulled back, even though it's 80% complete or what have you. So that's unfortunate as well.
What about battery storage? How much area do you need for battery storage?
Yeah, great question. There's it depends on the manufacturer, and generally a battery will pair with the inverter. The inverter in a solar system is what does the DC to AC conversion. We all use AC in our homes and businesses. Mm-hmm. So the batteries will pair with that. They range in sizes, maybe 3 to 4 feet wide by maybe roughly that height. It's a range depending on the manufacturer. So you need some available wall space next to your, say your electrical panel that we'd be interconnecting with. And every battery system also generally has a transfer switch. So if there's, say, an outage, it's detection of that power from the grid. Oh, let's go to the battery source, the backup power. And solar,
but it's still smaller than a furnace.
Yeah, yes, definitely. That's a good point. Yeah, it's not freestanding either. But and solar pairs really well because you can charge those batteries during the day and then use that power at night to try to offset some of your loads. And then you can size it and keep on growing the battery system to meet your needs.
Well, I tell you what, this has been a great short conversation, Dieter. We'll have to get you back and go into some more detail on the nuts and bolts of putting them together.
Absolutely.
In the meantime, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah,
appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Larry, for you and your team for allowing us the opportunity to come speak and answer some questions. There's a lot more questions out there. So.
Oh, yeah, there are indeed. Dieter Dettling, our guest today, project manager for Full Spectrum Solar. They're based in Madison. Dieter designs and installs photovoltaic solar arrays for both homes and businesses. And you can find them, of course, online at Full Spectrum Solar. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to something called strip cropping, but a little different from what, if you've been around a long time, you've heard about strip cropping, but this one involves native prairie plants. That next. I'm Larry Mealer. If you want to succeed as a farmer, you need healthy soil and clean water. And one strategy to conserve soil quality is intentionally growing strips of native prairie in the middle of farm fields. We'll talk about that today. Prairie strips, they're called, with Tim Youngquist. Tim is an Iowa farmer and an agricultural specialist in the Iowa State University Agronomy Department. also a farmer, as I mentioned, liaison for the ISU program testing and promoting prairie strips amid row crops. Have you seen wide strips of prairie grass in the middle of a farm field? Do you wonder how prairie and crops can benefit one another? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Tim Youngquist, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for inviting me to be here.
You operate a farm in Iowa. Your family has owned that farm since 1871. How's farming today compared to when it was established 150 years ago?
That's a good question. Yeah, a lot has changed in that amount of time. You know, the land is still the same, so you know, still walking on the same area, but you know, equipment's gotten a lot bigger. We certainly grow a lot more corn and soybeans. Everything's intensified quite a bit more, but there's still a lot of things that are fairly similar.
Yeah, there are. And you have one thing that's maybe changed a bit is the conservation projects that you've employed and put in place on your farm.
Yeah, that's right. So, like I said, you know, having the farm and the family for over 150 years, it's been important to be good stewards of that land and try to help keep the soil in place, you know, filter the water, rainwater as it's coming, and then providing some habitat for, you know, grassland birds, for bumblebees, you know, monarch butterflies, all that kind of stuff that help kind of increase quality of life. So that's some things that, you know, we've got corn and soybean land, but then we've targeted areas, you know, that are environmentally sensitive or difficult to farm or lower producing, and put those in the native tallgrass prairie, which is kind of the, basically here from all over the upper Midwest, prairie would have been the dominant ground cover if you go back about 150, 200 years ago.
Yeah. I was thinking back to my time in high school, which is a long time ago. Now I was taking vocational ag classes, and we were talking about strip cropping, contour farming, strip cropping back then. Maybe alfalfa or other types of plants, not prairie plants.
Yeah, so this is an idea, the prairie strips. It started at Iowa State University, and I'm kind of just representing that, you know, big interdisciplinary team. But an idea that started, you know, could we put something out in the corn and soybean fields, again, to keep that soil in place and filter water? Those are kind of the two main goals. And now, you know, here we are, 20 years later, and this is a nationwide conservation practice. So, you know, here in the upper Midwest, we've worked with a lot of the surrounding Midwest states and kind of done similar programs to make this available in places like Wisconsin and Illinois, Missouri, Indiana, you know, a lot of the states around here.
And if you know, just thinking about soil loss, I looked at the Wisconsin farm average loss. It depends on the soil and and all the steepness and so forth, but it's somewhere between 1 and 5 tons per acre per year, what is a ton? About 22 cubic feet.
Well, and it's, to build on that, you know, you think 5 tons, so you'd basically be driving a dump truck full for every 2 acres every year, but that's only the thickness of a dime. So in a year, you know, it's kind of this insidious problem where every time the rain falls, really every time the wind blows, it's moving around a little bit in those corn and soybean systems. But if you were to go outside your door tomorrow, you know, walk outside of your radio studio and the ground was a dime lower, you might not notice. It's something that is easy to ignore, but you know, for somebody like my dad that's been farming for over 40 years, that gets to be a pretty big stack of dimes. And that's kind of what we're seeing over 150 years of farming.
I saw some, I looked online, I was looking for some research on this, and I actually found some Iowa research. You're probably familiar with it, but this was in 2024, the results were published, but in Iowa, someone had done the average topsoil depth, and at the start of the 20th century. And then they took it again at the start of the 21st century. And the soil depth in the 20th century averaged in Iowa 14 to 18 inches. And it was averaging in the start of the 20th century at 6 to 8 inches. So you're absolutely right. It's only a thin dime, but over the course of time, that's a huge amount.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, important to realize we have really productive soils here in the upper Midwest.
Yes.
Some of the best soils in the world. We are always going to be using them to produce something. But, you know, being aware that there are tools like prairie strips, cover crops, contour farming, you know, there's all kinds of things that are available to farmers. And I think part of my job, specifically at Iowa State, is just to try to get this information out in front of people, to let farmers and landowners know, hey, we're having some unintended consequences from all this production. And here are a laundry list of things. You know, whatever you're interested in, there's a place that you can kind of get started with doing conservation on your farm.
Yeah, absolutely. Lauren had shot an email to us. And this is interesting. She says, aren't these prairie strips in the middle of a field actually inviting insects only to be sprayed with crop chemicals? Are there studies showing this is not the case?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's one that I get all the time when we're out. And the neat thing about what we're doing at Iowa State is we're not just putting prairie out there. Ever since the initial, so this idea kind of started in 2004. We did our initial seedings, the initial plots in 2007. And those plots were heavily instrumented. So, you know, we put groundwater wells, we put hydrologic flumes to measure rainfall. You know, looked at ground beetles, looked at native bees, looked at honeybees, you know, just looking at all these different categories. And certainly putting broadleaf plants in a field where you're going to be spraying for broadleaves, or trying to invite insects into a field where you're spraying insecticide, you know, these things seem to be contrary to each other. The nice thing, or the kind of encouraging thing, is that the data doesn't really support that. You know, yes, I'm a farmer. I'm not trying to apologize for farming, but it is neat to think, and again, depends on the situation, but it is amazing that you can have corn and prairie right next to each other and still be able to not only have a habitat sink where insects, monarchs are flying in, and then not being able to complete their life cycle, but you're actually producing more of specifically monarchs and things like that. Again, more study needs to be done. And, you know, we're talking strips, and you're saying in the middle of the field. That's kind of true. I think look at it more broadly as we're looking for opportunities to put habitat out in a field. So bigger chunks, either on the edge of the field or even in the middle of the field, wider is always going to be better for wildlife. You know, they're just going to have more cover. They're going to have more pollen resources, more places to make a home. So, again, prairiestrips.org is our website. We have dozens of peer-reviewed scientific publications. And I would encourage your listeners, if they are interested, to go and look at some of those papers that have been written on that topic to see, yes, there is some exposure to chemical to those creatures, but it's at really low levels or at sub-lethal levels. So to me, that's encouraging as a way that it's kind of going to work for the farmers and work for the environment.
Well, one thing that I thought about, and maybe I thought about it because I read about it someplace, but if you're planting, if you're attracting insects to this area, which you obviously are, you're also attracting a lot of beneficial insects that actually could be helpful in terms of working against those that are not so beneficial.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think we have seen a lot of benefits for holding soil in place, filtering nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen, and then creating habitat for pollinators, creating habitat for grassland birds. But as far as, you know, beneficial insects, yes, there are ground beetles that are eating weed seeds. You know, there are predatory wasps. There are all these things. But my sense as someone who is not a scientist is that that's a little bit of a drop in the bucket compared to, compared to the weed pressure that you'd be feeling. So yes, you're having some of that, but not in a way that is going to be immediately noticeable. And I know one of my colleagues did a study again on ground beetles and found there was a lot higher diversity of beetles and there were more beetles in fields with prairie strips, but that they were ranging less far into the field. So they can kind of be fat and happy just in that prairie where they can get a lot of their needs met. And then they're not, it's not as though they're this army that's going into the field and eating bugs. I wish that it was, but
it's not the case. It's kind of
drop in the ocean.
Tim Youngquist, our guest today, an Iowa farmer, a strips farmer liaison, and an ag specialist in the Iowa State University Agronomy Department, talking about strip farming with native prairies. And I hope you'll join in. Questions for him, give a call. We've already had a couple of good ones. What about you? Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email the email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at strip cropping with native prairies, there's a lot of research going on, and one of the people involved is Tim Youngquist, an Iowa farmer, a strips farmer liaison, ag specialist in the Iowa State University Department of Agronomy. So it's great to have him with us. And again, questions or comments, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. On those strips, the strips themselves, they can't be just narrow. They need to be at least, 30 feet wide? Is that a good amount?
Yeah, I would say 30 feet is a great starting point. If you were to enroll them in some kind of a USDA program, what the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resource Conservation Service recommends is anywhere from 30 to 120 feet wide. So again, it kind of depends on whatever your goals are and whatever your land looks like and where, imagining the biggest cost of these is going to be the opportunity cost you lose from taking the cash crop land out of production. So being mindful, the more prairie you have, the less crop that you have. But anything less than 30, I would not suggest.
So what's the payback for a farmer? I mean, it would be might be difficult to convince a farmer that, why do I want to take 30 feet of or 100 feet of land out of production?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and that's a lot of what I've kind of dealt with for I've been at this job with the agronomy department for the last 12 years. So I've had a lot of experience and gone all over the Midwest. But the thing to think about is as we have these vast swaths of the upper Midwest in the corn production, not all of those acres are going to yield the same way. You know, if you thought of them as 10 by 10 grid squares and you think of each one as a franchise restaurant, since we're in Wisconsin, as a Culver's, you know, you think of there's going to be some Culver's that will make more money than others. Those that were making less money, you would probably close down and you would focus on the ones that are better. So if you can target the areas that are either lower producing, maybe particularly steep, you know, as we have large equipment, there are areas that it can be difficult to get your combine, your planter, your sprayer. You know, if your sprayer is 120 feet wide, trying to squeeze that into a little triangle can be a challenge. So depending upon what your goals are, but trying to be mindful of where will the prairie make the most sense in an area that is either costing you money, because if you have an eroded hillside, you are spending the same amount on expensive inputs. I mean, nitrogen, it's very expensive, herbicide, diesel fuel, your time, And as you're going back and forth and you're planting this stuff, some of those acres are either going to be not making you very much money or actively losing you money. So we've got a lot of precision ag technology that we can target those areas and think, all right, you have some areas that are maybe showing up as red or not yielding very well on this yield map. Would it make sense to put an area like that into some tall grass prairie? Then you get the environmental benefits that come with that. And if you enroll it into a USDA program, you're paid for putting it in and you're paid an annual rental payment every year for the land that's taken out of production.
So you're going to come out pretty well if you tie it with a government program. And those programs are not going away.
And if you're trying to plant corn into a parking lot and that corn is only growing 4 or 5 feet tall and it's not really producing much of an ear, again, you're spending the same amount on the seed that you put there as you put in the nice bottom ground with a 4 foot deep topsoil. You know, the corn belt, it's not uniform. You know, each field could be managed a little bit more delicately. And again, under my house and under your radio studio, this was prairie. You know, if you go back 200 years, just about everybody, whether it's your front yard, your backyard, your field, whatever it is, prairie was the ground cover. And I think that's one of the best things about this project is it's just so simple. You know, we're not trying to find some fantastical magic plant from somewhere else and around the world, just putting what the native ground cover was. And very quickly after you seed the prairie, you know, you start to see the grassland birds that are in steep decline. You start to see more pollinators and you start to, you know, have more infiltration of the water. You have less soil moving around, all those things.
So, and I think farmers, for the most part, welcome wildlife and we've gotten away from wildlife habitat on farms, at least, in Iowa, Wisconsin, and some of our Midwest states where, I mean, we're planting, you know, we've done away with those fence lines and so forth that were there before.
You're exactly right. And I mean, I think that's kind of the story, really, the country over. And, you know, really a lot of this change has happened in the last 40 or 50 years, where some of those, you know, I have taken out way more fence in my life than I've ever put in. But those little strips of grass along the fence line were providing some cover and some habitat, and there might have been some native species and things in there. So, again, to be able to just kind of in a targeted way put some of this stuff back in. And, you know, farming, boy, there's a lot of stuff that you can't control. You got markets, you got weather, you're always lifting heavy stuff. There's always stuff, things to do. But to be able to take a part of your property and have blooming flowers and grasses from April to about October, you know, and my wife can have a bouquet of cut flowers on her table basically all summer long. You know, my son, I've got three kids. My son is the oldest. He's 6 years old, and he could probably name 20 prairie plants. I didn't know any prairie plants until I was about 20. You know, there's a real quality of life that comes with this that can, from some of the sociological work we do interviewing farmers that have done the Prairie Strips Project, it very quickly becomes their favorite spot on the farm. You know, a place to go for a walk after supper. I mean, just a place to kind of enjoy nature and have a spot that you can kind of unwind, and the spring isn't quite so tightly coiled as it is in the rest of the fields.
Yeah, I would think that would be the case. So far, what's your research found in terms of improved soil and water retention? You've certainly done some research.
Yep. So, and again, encourage the listeners to go to the website, prairiestrips.org. What we found is that, again, it depends on placement, but if you can put prairie where the water is flowing through the field, imagine where it's either coming into the field or leaving, you can achieve a 95% reduction in soil erosion. So the movement of soil can be reduced, not to zero, but by taking 10% of a field and putting it into prairie, you receive disproportionate benefits. So 95% soil, wow, that's pretty staggering. And then it's about a 44% reduction in the overall amount of rainwater that's coming off of that parcel. So imagine as the rain falls, it's absorbing into last year's plant material. It's being slowed by the stiff grasses and the stiff stems of the plants. It's infiltrating down in. And then it's about an 84% reduction in the export of phosphorus and about an 80 or 90% reduction in phosphorus and an 84% reduction in nitrogen. So phosphorus and nitrogen are two of our main fertilizers that are really valuable on the farm, but quickly become a problem for anybody else as soon as they can get into a water course and start moving off the property and downstream. And then three times the abundance of pollinators and double the abundance of grassland birds. So I think, and there's more to it than that, but those are kind of the main benefits. And I think that alone shows, again, the benefits that you can get are clear, and the way that it can be applied where you can really circle on your field, where do you want this? You know, is it up around your house, your farmstead? Is it down by the creek? Is it, you know, on a steep hillside, whatever it is, that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has made this a very flexible program, acknowledging that farmers are going to be more interested in something if they can kind of tailor it to their operation.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I'm thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, they cut it 90%. And you had an area that you were losing 5 tons of topsoil per acre. Suddenly you're losing less than a ton.
Yeah, and you know, we've been doing this for 150 years. I would think that I would, you know, delusionally maybe, but I would like to think that my great-great-grandchildren would still be farming my land in 150 years or my family's land. We're going to have a difficult time producing these high yielding crops if we don't take care of our resource base, which is that soil. So again, just strategically looking where the water really doesn't care. The water is going to flow across your property basically in the same spot every single year. If your listeners could think about, again, where is that water leaving the field and where is it coming onto the field? And if that would be a starting point, I think that's kind of the easiest entry point. You know, don't start with 50 acres. Maybe start with 5 acres. Just start small because you have to mow it during establishment. The seed's a little bit expensive, you know, and then there's maybe some prescribed burning or some other management that's going to have to go with that. So just kind of starting small, again, talk to your local USDA office, and they've got all the technical advice, all the resources, and then some cost share to help put this stuff in.
And on your prairiestrips.org, I think you even have some comments from farmers who have actually adopted this.
Yep, we have a lot of testimonials. And then I was actually just up in Milwaukee, probably 2 weeks ago, working with a group called the Sand County Foundation. Mm-hmm. They've been good friends to us up there, and they've done a lot of work getting Prairie Strips on the ground up in Wisconsin and kind of replicating some of the trials that we've done here in Iowa. So, you know, not only are there the testimonials on the website, but I would really encourage you look for field days in your area where you could get out to maybe a neighbor's property and see, you know, what does this actually look like close to where you're farming?
Well, it sounds like a win-win to me, and I'm really glad to have you guys working on this. You've been doing it now for a while. You got some good data. You got some good papers out of it.
Yep, the data really gives us, you know, I like Prairie. I'm not going to lie about that, but to have the data to stand on to say, hey, here's all these decimal points, here's these charts, here's these graphs from, you know, years and years of study across numerous institutions and numerous different people. And again, they're, you know, farmers are looking for a way to help keep their soil in place, to add some habitat, filter the water, and this is a way that you can really get at those things. And if we are going to clean up the water that's coming off of farmland, practices like Prairie Strips can really help, and then they can kind of just improve the overall quality of life on that farm and in the community.
Tim, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate your time very much on this. Maybe we can do this again down the road here. Tim Youngquist, Iowa farmer, a Strips farmer liaison, and an ag specialist at the Iowa State University Agronomy Department. And that website is prairiestrips.org. Thanks to our team, Jeff Robbins, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, and let's see, who did I forget? Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff, and Jill.